Today is Bodhidharma's birthday. And I do love birthdays. So I thought I would talk about Bodhidharma a little bit, but actually with a slightly different slant. So I want to warn you that at the end of the talk, instead of our traditional Gassho dedication, I'll invite you to join me in a shout-out to Bodhidharma for his birthday. So get your lungs ready. Get ready. We're going to do a 1-2 shout for Bodhidharma. So just everybody know we're going to get some blood pumping at the end here. So, Bodhidharma came from the West, from India to China, to revitalize Buddhism in China. And it was a huge undertaking to do that at that time, and he traveled there, and he spent a lot of time in the south of China studying and practicing, and then he began to move through the country, toward the north of the country. And along the way, Emperor Wu heard that this sage was in China, and so he sought him out and met him. And, this is the famous, very, very famous story that we're all left with about Bodhidharma's encounter with Emperor Wu, in which Emperor Wu, had been a very devout Buddhist in his view. He was fulfilling his practice, and he came to Bodhidharma to see if Bodhidharma would validate that and what Bodhidharma would say about that. So he approached Bodhidharma and said, I have built temples, great temples, and I support priests and clergy, and I am a Buddhist. What merit have I earned? And Bodhidharma said, no merit. And of course, from Emperor Wu's point of view, that was just shocking, because he had done all that thinking that there was merit or gain, like heaven or something. It's not an uncommon human idea. So he presents his humanness to Bodhidharma. Come on, I've been doing all this. There must be something in it for me. And Bodhidharma says, no, not really. And so Emperor Wu says, well, so he's confused. He's a little addled. He says, then what are these teachings that you're bringing here? What is the essence of this Buddhism that you bring? Because Emperor Wu thought he was practicing the essence of Buddhism. And Bodhidharma said, vast emptiness, no holiness. Emptiness? I mean, that was something new. Bodhidharma could not see that. He couldn't hear it. And so he said to Bodhidharma, well, if that's the case, then who are you? Or who is this before me? And Bodhidharma said famously, I don't know. And so that's the recorded exchange between them. And then Bodhidharma, the legend goes, rode on a single reed of grass across the Yangtze River. So it's some of this, but what is that single reed? I mean, we can always see it as sort of symbolic, even if we don't, think that maybe that's exactly what happened. But what I want to focus on is not Bodhidharma, because I think Bodhidharma gets a good deal of press. I want to focus on Emperor Wu, who I think kind of gets a bad rap from us. I've heard this story 100 times in my practice, and every time Emperor Wu's like this little doofus who gets out there to Bodhidharma and, asks dumb questions and gets really brilliant answers and can't hear it, and is befuddled and leaves, and just poor old Emperor Wu, he missed his moment. And kind of that's how he's seen in this historical story. So I thought, well, what is with Emperor Wu? Because clearly this guy really was devoted. I mean, he sought out Bodhidharma, right? That's Bodhi mind. I mean, that's bodhicitta arising in him. He clearly had a big Bodhi heart to make this kind of effort to seek out this sage who really wasn't even acknowledged in China. But he, the emperor, makes this tremendous effort. And I think that in itself is beautiful. And regardless of what he was able to receive, he himself came there wholeheartedly. And he dialogued with Bodhidharma. And I don't know how many people here have had a dialogue with a very powerful Zen master. It's not easy to hold your ground there and come back with two or three questions. No merit. I mean, he was pretty quick on his feet. Well, if that's the case, you know. So, I mean, I think that he was probably a really smart guy. He had been, prior to becoming emperor, he had been a criminal. He had been basically a lawless guy. He had murder in his past. He had been not a very good guy, not a very nice guy in terms of the law of the land. And upon becoming emperor, he converted to Buddhism. And he felt that that was, you know, he felt that there was some return for that. So he practiced a Buddhism where if you build temples and support the priests, you gain something. You're practicing. And so maybe Bodhidharma brought something different. Clearly, Bodhidharma brought something shockingly different. And maybe we could say, well, what Bodhidharma brought was better, or was more authentic, or was more in tune with the principles or the practice. But Emperor Wu did it without looking good. Right? He just showed up there with the master and said, "Here I am. What's here? What's for me?" Right? Which I think is just a normal human question. So I actually think we can, you know, I think that Emperor Wu really reformed his life with and saved all beings with his Buddhism. That he was able to abandon a life that was failing, that was unskillful, that was doing harm, and to devote himself, whether we think it was the right Buddhism or that he was able to devote himself, portions of his fortune, his wherewithal, his resources, to what he thought was the deepest practice that he could bring to his country, to his people, and to himself. So I think we can admire Emperor Wu and see him as actually just as a big a Buddha, let's say, as the great sage. Without him, our whole historical understanding of Bodhidharma would be completely different than it is. So he actually becomes the catalyst for Bodhidharma's great opportunity to share, to cut through, and give to China what he had to give. So I was reading the Eno's blog at San Francisco Zen Center. So Valerie Beer, who has been here, she did sutra writing with us a couple years ago. She wrote this. She said, "Bodhidharma knew that Emperor Wu needed to be told that his temples and pious good works were not his true nature." So truthfully, it was amazingly generous of Bodhidharma to point this out to Emperor Wu. He certainly didn't do it to win friends in high places. He did it because it was his function to be a mirror for Emperor Wu, a real mirror, a true mirror. You know, building these temples, it's nice. I mean, Bodhidharma didn't say it was wrong to build temples. He just said it's empty. It doesn't have any real substance. So temples burn down, they die, they go away, they're just like all everything ephemeral in the impermanent world. They are empty. Empty of merit, empty of self, empty of self. But in China, you know, in India, people practiced in the forest because it was temperate weather. They could practice in the forest. And in the rainy season, they came together in what they called angos, we call practice periods, which were times when all the community, thousands of monks came together and practiced it actually in buildings. Okay, but for most of the climate was temperate. They go to China, it's freezing. So nobody's sitting in the forest in China. They're sitting in temples. So Emperor Wu built those temples. And we can say, well, that doesn't have merit. In and of itself, it doesn't. But neither does sitting in those temples, in and of itself, have merit. So I think that we have sort of lowered Emperor Wu because he wasn't able to completely receive Bodhidharma's vast message. He wasn't able to see it. But I have to look a little more deeply at him and see what was this? What was Emperor Wu? What did he do? And I think he did what many of us do. He came sincerely to his practice, to what he thought was his best effort. He made it sincerely. He pursued the best of the finest teaching in the land that he felt he could find. He made tremendous effort. He dialogued with Bodhidharma. He didn't just back away. He didn't say, he's okay, well then, what about this and what about that? So he did encounter Bodhidharma. And that takes great stability. So when I really started thinking about what Emperor Wu did, to go from a life of crime, a life of thinking that you're outside society and you can do what you want because your family's rich and you're at the top of the heap, to converting his heart to a practice that nourished his society. And as an emperor, I don't know what more really one could do than he actually made a profound offering culturally, Emperor Wu, before Bodhidharma came. And then Bodhidharma told him there was no merit in it for him, but it still didn't take away, I feel, from his effort and his contribution, which actually made it possible for Bodhidharma and his practitioners to have place and to practice in a country that wasn't geographically friendly to year-long outdoor practice. So, so Valerie goes on. She says, in refusing to define himself, Bodhidharma suggested that perhaps the emperor too might take a break from his identity. So it's not that the temples are bad. There's nothing wrong with building temples. Here we have this temple. Many, many people built this temple. Many, many people, living and dead, built this temple. This temple... This temple is a sacred and beautiful place, but in itself it's empty. And it is, what makes this place what it is you. And that's what Emperor Wu was telling, that's what Bodhidharma was telling Emperor Wu. He was saying, those temples, not so much, but you here. Right? And of course, Emperor Wu's empty too. But I think Valerie says, but the emperor did not understand and missed a golden opportunity to find the sacred within himself. And I think that's what I would like to convey. That we think of the temple as a sacred place. It's a beautiful place. Great effort to create this, to uphold it, to sustain it. And ultimately, it is not what is sacred here. What is sacred here is you. And you find that within yourself. And you find that in the emptiness of yourself, in the interconnectedness of yourself with everyone, in the complete absence of separation between you and everything you experience. That's what's sacred. And if it's in the temple, lovely. And if it's at the 7-Eleven, lovely. And if it's in your car, lovely. Because all of that is Dharma. Every one of those places is a sacred place. And that's really the message of Bodhidharma. Yes, the temples are nice, but they're not special. Because what is sacred is your existence. Actually, not even you, but your existence, your life. So in thinking about all this and thinking about Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu, and thinking about Santa Cruz, I realized, you know, Catherine Thanos was Bodhidharma to my Emperor Wu. And so maybe that's why I had to give 10 minutes of why Emperor Wu is okay. But, you know, Emperor Wu, when Bodhidharma died, said, "Alas, I saw him without seeing him. I met him without meeting him. I encountered him without encountering him. Now, as then, I deeply regret this." So years later, what had Emperor Wu been doing with himself? He apparently had been practicing deeply with Bodhidharma's questions, with Bodhidharma, with the surprise and the shock of Bodhidharma's responses to him. It seems to me he had to have been holding those and encountering them over and over again and holding them up to his temples and his offerings to priests and so forth. He had to be holding up that question of emptiness to everything he did from then on, because he says, "Now as then, I regret this." So he has this open-heartedness toward Bodhidharma's teaching. He wants to understand it, we could say. He works at it. I mean, I really think Emperor Wu tried, you know. So anyway, and he did miss Bodhidharma when Bodhidharma was in front of him. He saw him without seeing him. How often do we do that? So that's really what I'd like to talk about for just a few more minutes. So I'm going to pass these around. This is a picture of Catherine. It's probably my favorite picture of the abbot. And so I have made a copy of it for you. And on the back just is the quote that I just gave from Bodhidharma, or from Emperor Wu. Sorry. Thank you, Jeff. I apologize. There's 12 of these. If anybody who doesn't get one wants one, you can. I'll be happy to email you one or something. But it's a lovely little picture of Catherine, of Catherine's back. And it's so Catherine. It's such a Catherine picture. So I'll just say this. I lost my glasses. I have a new pair of glasses. These are my old ones. These are single vision lenses. I bought these new progressives, and I mean, they cost a lot of money, and I hemmed and hawed and saved, and finally, okay, I'm going to bite the bullet, buy these glasses. I bought them. I've been wearing glasses since I was 4 years old. 50 years I've worn glasses, okay? And I have lost my glasses once before in my life, and that was after I'd had them about 3 days. And these were the ones I got when I was four. Anybody here who's worn glasses your whole life? So, you know, back then, right, glasses were blue plastic with wings. Remember? Did you ever? So you might be younger than I am. If you never had wings on your glasses, you're younger than I am. But I hated them. Okay, they just did not fit the little butch, burgeoning person that I was, you know. But I could see, so I wore them. And the very, like, second or third day, I got home and they were gone. My mom says, "Where are your glasses?" I don't know. They're gone. So she drives me back the route to school, and there they are in the middle of the crosswalk, middle of the street, smashed. My glasses. So that was the one time in my life that I lost my glasses and just like in thin air and had no idea. And they had obviously just, I probably running, they fell off my face, whatever, they were gone. Okay, my mother was not happy with me. But Saturday night, I had dinner with friends. I had my glasses on. My friends believe I had my glasses on all night. I actually asked. Sunday, and I always, so I travel to, you know, Buddhist centers and work and all kinds of hotels and stuff. So I have a habit. When I take my glasses off at night, I do this. This is absolutely habitual. I do this. I take them by the nose rim, and I lay them within my arm's reach. So it doesn't matter what's within arm's reach. Is it the floor? Is it a chest? I don't care. If I'm at somebody's house, what is it? But they will be, when I awake, within arm's reach. Okay? Habitual. 50 years. They're gone. My glasses disappeared on Sunday morning. They were not in arm's reach. Today's Wednesday. I've been searching for them for 3 days. I will tell you this. I am certain I have seen them. My eyes have seen them. but my mind cannot see them. I am seeing them without seeing them. I'm convinced of it. They're somewhere I'm looking, and I'm not seeing them. So this is kind of like Emperor Wu. You know, I saw him. I know I saw him, but I didn't see him. What is that? What is that? I saw, but I didn't see. Or I spoke with him for half an hour, but I don't think he heard a word I said. What is it to be, to hear without hearing? To encounter, but not encounter? Do you have this experience? Because, I mean, I think it's really deep, deep thing, question to ask. What is it to see? Is it your eyes that see? What sees? And what doesn't see? I think my eyes are seeing my glasses. I bet they are. But they're up against some background that my mind can't distinguish between them and the color of, I don't know. Or they're so unexpected wherever they are that I just can't believe. I can't believe it, so I can't see them. I don't know. I'm throwing these out as just, you know, kinds of, this is my life for the last 3 days. And I think this is not unlike sort of an Emperor Wu kind of experience, where it's just baffling. You're like, what happened? So it's glasses. It's actually a physical thing. And I'm pretty sure. I mean, I've searched. I've upended everything. I dumped my compost bin. I dug through everything in my compost. My compost is nice. You know, no glasses in there. I dug through all my trash cans. I dumped out my 30-gallon bucket out front. Now, I'm in San Mateo's really posh neighborhood. I'm out there with all my, you know, this piles of trash. I'm out there. This is my glasses. I can't believe it. So I'm out there. You know, it was, so I'm sure my neighbors, who always are at their kitchen windows when I do anything, had fun with me out there, you know, in the city dump, trying to find my glasses. So I did not find them in my trash bin, so I did not see them. This is not them. And the it's a good question, though, because that could happen, too. But the incredible thing is that they could very well have been hauled to the dump in my trash, right? And I went through that. I didn't see them. So I just don't know. I don't know. I'm left just completely not knowing what this is, what happened, why didn't I do my usual habitual thing? Did I do my habitual thing and they fell? Or I don't know. So what is seeing without seeing? You know, what is that? And it leaves me confused. Like, I mean, I think I emailed Jean. Like, I'm confused. I'm 54 years old. I haven't lost my glasses in 50 years. You know, what is this? It's discombobulating to see without seeing, to seek without finding, to just constantly, you know, and to know that you're doing that, to know that they're there. They're there. They have to be there. I never left my house. They have to be there. So I feel I also do this with people. I see you, but maybe do I really see you? Do I see you with my eyes? I see you with my eyes. Do I see you with my mind? I think I see you with my mind. Do I see you with my heart? I want to see you with my heart. Because I think that's where we really see. I think that's where seeing happens. And I don't always slow down enough to see with my heart. So I see with my eyes, and I see with my thoughts, my mind. I encounter with my thoughts, and I analyze the flower. So, because I don't slow down enough to let my heart encounter the flower, and be encountered by the flower. I think to see one, there's a mutuality to seeing and being seen. And I think to get to have that experience for me, it's slowing my body down enough to actually have my heart present where my mind is and where my mouth is and where my eyes are. So that I can really see. Jean? No, thanks. You feel free to come on up and look. Maybe you could see them. I do think it. Maybe the whole Sangha could file through there. Somebody would be able to see them. They're there. Yeah, it is. Right.
And then on the other side of that scene, there's someone who might allow the scene for a second.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. a little too close.
Yeah.
That's a little too much. Or I myself mm-hmm. have been seen
right.
and met the games, but then the alarm goes off.
Yes.
And I go, oh,
right.
I see you see me, but I don't want you to see me either.
And that's mutual. I see you see me. The mutuality has already occurred. Actually, the mutuality occurred before either of you saw each other. But you encountered one another, and you shut down, or someone had to protect themselves, and for whatever reason, you know, we don't even have to know the reason, and you know. I don't think that takes away from your seeing. Now you might say, I only saw for a split second and I'd like to see more. So that to me is bodhicitta. That's bodhicitta. It's a little flame there. Ooh, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go sit again. I'm going to go talk to Nettie again. I'm going to go meet the master again. I'm going to go ask a second question of Bodhidharma. That's a little bit of bodhi energy there, saying, you know, just for that split second, I think that's actually kind of how I stayed in Buddhism, was that I started practice in Southern California in my Zumi Roshi's lineage. And I had, it was 1991, and I had been, you know, in graduate school, and so on many years, but I had been in a religious cult, which was, which really, you know, kind of did me in for religion. My sister says that's a hard argument to make now, but it did me in for religion. I was very worried, very scared. I went in there just scared to death, you know, just frightened. These people are going to, you know, do something. So I had been in a cult, so I was very nervous about going to this monastery and being, you know, not able to leave. I mean, they had all, you know, things like that were said. You can't leave, things like that. And I said, oh, yeah, I can leave. And, so I panicked, basically. I went through the workshop, which was great, and then day three was Sunday, and that's when they did their public program. So they all show up in their robes, black robes, and then they're all bowing and bowing to each other. I'm like, ugh, you guys, now, you're scaring me. Gene, and I bolted out of the room. I just bolted out the room, body and soul. I said, you know, and I'm like, I was bawling. Like, you people are from the devil. I mean, you know, really. And it was extreme neurological activation, which made it impossible for me to remain in the room. I could not be with my body in the room, okay? So I left. I bolted out. And I thought, well, and I went down, there was this table downstairs and outside. So I went and sat at the table just to kind of get my bearings, and then I was going to leave. I'm going to pack up my stuff and get out of there. And pretty soon I hear these footsteps, and Sasan, this priest, brand new priest, comes walking down out the deck and around the zendo and down these stairs. And she just comes and sits at the table with me. She doesn't say anything. And I'm bawling, and I'm still, you know, like, you know, you people are from the devil, and I think you're trying to trick me, and who are you bowing to anyway? And I mean, all my karma, all my ancient twisted karma with religion and silence and darkness and black robes and all of that came to the fore. And it was overwhelming. It absolutely blew me out of the zendo. But Sasan sat there about 20 minutes, probably me bawling and going on and how awful and what would it, and okay. And she says, she waits till I'm done. She leans into me and she says, and I'm thinking in my mind, okay, so she's going to say, when she leaned, I thought, can I help you pack? And what she said was, what would it take for you to be here with us? Oh, hadn't thought of that. So she met me. I was not able to meet her then yet. I still know her, but it took me probably 20 years to actually be able to see and feel in my body what the vastness with which she was meeting me. And she did that over and over again. And so I think, in a sense, you know, that was my Dharma gate, was the physiological activation from my history, basically severe PTSD still in my body, which I just reacted to. And but the Sangha held that. They did not need for that to go away. They did not have to shut down. Maybe some people did, I don't know, but in general, they didn't. And so probably I was more seen than able to see initially, just like Bodhidharma with Emperor Wu. I mean, they still kept telling me I didn't exist, that there was no self, you know, scaring me. But I kept going back because these people are real. There's some kind of thing here that I want to be like that. I want to be that vast. Seisen saw me with her heart. If she had seen me only with her eyes, she would have packed me while I was sitting at the table and brought my bags to me. Okay? But she saw me with her heart, and she said, "What would it take? What do we need to be to make space for you?" And and then, frankly, what they did is I basically sat outside because I couldn't go in the zendo. I said, "I can't go in that room." Okay, Sabutan on the deck. Beautiful. Just where are you? What can we be? So I wasn't able to see, but I was seen, and that's very much like Emperor Wu was completely seen by Bodhidharma, but wasn't able to see. And yet, it was a mutual meeting, because Emperor Wu, years later, carried that, was still working it. I don't think he didn't encounter him. I think he encountered Bodhidharma. And I think he was pretty hard on himself in this inscription when he said, "I didn't encounter him." Because if he hadn't encountered him, how could he have worked for all those years with his questions? He would have just thrown it out of his mind, like it didn't, never happened. He was deeply affected and kept at it. Even though he didn't see it, he didn't understand it, he kept at it. And maybe that persistence, you know, is what I like so much about him. He never has to see. He's perfect, just like that. He never has to see. He's perfect, just like that. But did he miss something? Yes, I guess he did. And yet, he received it also. Because if he hadn't received it, this inscription wouldn't exist. He was moved, even if he wasn't fully able to comprehend it. Maybe he received it in his body, but not his mind. He couldn't comprehend it, but he received it in some way, some very real way. And I think that's what happened to me too. And I also think it's what it characterizes when I look at my 11 years of study with Catherine. It characterizes my practice with her, that she saw, and I did not see. That's okay. Dana, I regret it. It's okay.
Can you draw such a theme teaching? I remember Catherine used to sometimes say, "It's amazing we ever actually really communicate with one
another." Yeah.
But then, you know, the discussion that you gave tonight is really that even in those moments when you think you're missing,
yeah,
you're not fully missed or are fully missing.
Right.
Because that's only looking just at that one little scratch in time,
yep.
As opposed to over kind of the long run.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to draw you someone to ask you a question and then make a comment. Maybe I'll make the comment first. So the same little gremlin that took my glasses, I've never lost a pair of glasses.
I did too. Both my dogs. I had a stick up with my dogs over these glasses. Toys, dog houses. Yeah. Did you find yours? Well, maybe it's the same pair, you know, and we just think they're two pair. And maybe they're at my house, or you know, I mean, it's hard to know, you know.
So I wanted to ask you this question about mutuality. It seems like this is a little bit of a lifetime thing, and it seems like it's a lifetime.
Yes, I think so.
So I guess in the same way that
Sesson asked, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Asked you, where do you go to practice-wise to make that happen, or to facilitate that opening of the heart?
Yeah. This is a very big question right now for me, because I think my heart's a little bit closed right now, actually. I go to Zazen to open my heart, because even though Zazen is difficult for me, it does adjust this instrument, and it seems to bring the body and mind sort of more into a similar pace, so that I can actually see you with my heart, and with my eyes, you know, or my mind, I should say. I think it's very body. It's very body. Mutuality is an embodied thing. I think I have mutuality. I mean, there's this great oak tree at this house I'm at, and this oak tree moves me for some reason. It's just gorgeous. It's huge. It's old. And it's knotty and rumble. So I go to that tree, and I really want to see this tree, you know. And when I slow down, and I stand by the tree, and I just, without thinking tree, right, without labeling it, just take in its magnificence. That oak tree. Opens. There is a, I mean, I'm not just, there is a mutuality. When I see it, I do feel that it sees me in a sense. I mean, seeing is a funny word, but it's a body sense for me about mutuality. I mean, I was walking at Wilder Ranch several months ago, and I came around the corner, and there was a little bush, and something attracted me. So I'm a greed type, so shiny things always attract me. So it was a beer can in the bush. And I went, oh, wow. And I'm telling you, it was beautiful. And I just took in the beer can in the bush. I just stood there breathing beer can in bush, and it became beautiful to me. It became, and I don't mean to say it's a special feeling. I'm just saying it doesn't matter if it's a beer can or a flower on the bush. The experience of meeting and, oh, what are you? And then feeling, oh, well, what am I here? We're here. You know, now even an inanimate object is somehow mutual in that. It's hard to explain. It's really unspoken. There's no way to speak it. I think it's a body experience. And I don't know if the beer can also has a body experience, or the bush also has a body experience. I don't know. But I feel that it is part of my experience of seeing. It's not separate. So I practice with that in many ways. I mean, primarily, you know, sitting. Also, quiet, just being quiet, quiet time. Trying to, as Catherine Fannis used to always encourage me to develop a taste for silence. So I try to not play music in my car. And, you know, when I am practicing with this, you know, seeing, being seen. So I'll do it on the freeway. I mean, I practice it when I'm racing by in a car. Can I see what's around me? Can I take in the 100 things that are happening in this moment? Actually see, you know, encounter them all. So just widening, you know, Zazen is a very inclusive practice. In Zazen, we're not asked to concentrate on one thing. We're asked to come back to the moment as a whole, over and over again, come back to the moment as it is, as it is. And that's a very, very mind-broadening practice. Because you have to include everything there is then. Anything there is there in the moment is included. And that's mutuality. Even if I don't know the nature of the thing, how it is mutual. I don't know how the beer can or the bush are mutual because I don't share their body. But I have a sense of mutuality in that encounter. But I also could equally run right by that beer can and never have that that opening of heart and mind. So stopping is probably the biggest piece. And you've bowed 3 times. Shut up, so. Edie?
Mm-hmm. It's not like one's better than the other. Right. You certainly need both.
Right.
And to me, when I'm hearing, it sounds like opening the heart is more like the intuitive side that pulls it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always get in trouble when I lean toward the analytical side in my life, even though it's important. I mean, I'm a very good planner. I'm analytical. But every time I rely on that, I do stupid things. What's that? Yeah, we need both. Yeah, exactly. But it's relying on the analysis, which is ephemeral and impermanent, and rather than relying on maybe this something that's less graspable, less nameable, less describable. It's harder to rely on that. In a sense, harder to make that solid, something solid. So, I get in trouble when I make things solid. And I think my analytical mind wants to make things solid. It's more comfortable for me if things are solid. And that's one way that I protect my heart, is to make things solid so I know what they are and then I can kind of take care of this. You know? But that's not the truth. So it creates a false agreement. and then I make mistakes and do harm from that space. So, and you know, and I don't sit to fabricate a Buddha. I sit to sit, and I sit because I have to sit. Actually, I tried a long time not to. if by chance a fruit of practice, of that practice, is that on this one occasion I can actually truly take in bush and beer can without making one sacred and one profane, then you know, that's great. But that's not why I sit. Because I don't think I'm probably going to be ever free of PTSD. I'm not ever going to be neurologically, it's wired. I don't think I can unwire that. So but maybe if I keep being able to be mutual with my own reactivity, to always look at it, to receive it, even if it's painful, maybe it will, maybe there is also some possibility for mutuality in that, for it to open, for me to open. But I don't know. I mean, that's all just, you just come back and sit right like you are, right like I am. Thank you. Helen? Yeah, that's a great insight. That yes, and I thought that, and of course I went to, oh, they cost so much. I've never paid so much for a pair. Oh, and I don't have any money. And you know what? It didn't matter if they were a $30 pair of glasses or a $500 pair of glasses. They disappeared. Everything disappears, you know. So yeah, I think that's right. And then the practice is to look at my seeking, my seeking, my continuing to go back beside the bed and look again, look again, look again under the mattress, look again under the blanket, look again, it's got to be there. That's that unrelenting, you know, it's very painful mind. And when in the moments when I can say, well, they just disappeared, forget it, they just disappeared, I'm actually calmer. And like, okay, well, they just disappeared. I'm not happy, but I'm calmer. So yeah, that seeking, grasping, you can really see it in times like this. When I was 4 and lost my glasses, I didn't care. My mother was the one grasping. It was her suffering. And apparently some 50 years later, the karma is still alive and well in our family. But I'm glad to hear about the glasses, Gremlin. I'm hoping that they're somewhere.
Did you say you had a dog?
I have 2 dogs.
So I would have to ask the question, you know,
dog ate them?
Moved them.
Yeah, no, I did a stick up with the dogs. I said, this is a stick up. And I searched their house and their beds and I did body searches. You know, I mean, I searched those, their dogs, and they like did this, nothing.
Did you try putting down another pair of glasses?
That's a good idea. I did with these the next day. I thought, okay, I'm going to see what I do with these when I go to bed. And I watched. And I did the same thing I'd habitually done for a few years. And they were there the next morning, so I don't know. But, I mean, I think it's just really incredible how just something as simple as this can show me myself so vividly, show me my greed, my fear, my vulnerability, my seeking and searching and sticking up the dogs and, you know, the whole thing. I mean, it's all part of that kind of mine, I've lost part of me, and it's really... It's more Emperor Wu than Bodhidharma, wouldn't you say? So, any other questions? Comments? Yeah, Bodhidharma. It's Bodhidharma's birthday. So we're gonna do a shout for Bodhidharma. So as loud as you can. This is our dedication. So we're actually dedicating this talk with our happy birthday shout. Bodhidharma. So I guess we should put our hands in Gassho for our dedication. And on 3, as loud as you can, this is for Bodhidharma. He's like 5th century. So it's got to be loud to get... Okay. 1, 2... Ah! Happy birthday, Bodhidharma! Thank you all very much. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Inexhaustible.